Good morning. We'd like to welcome you to our session this morning on Mormon polygamy and historical overview. Our presenter this morning will be George D. Smith. He is currently the president of Signature Books. He has an AB from Stanford and an MBA from New York University. He is the editor of An Intimate Chronicles, the Journal of William Clayton. More recently and about to come out is the Faithful History Essays on Writing Mormon History. He has a number of articles published. Defending the Keystone Book of Mormon was an article that he produced a couple of years ago in Sunstone that is something you might want to go back and review in retrospect. We're looking forward to hearing from him this morning. A little personal information: he has one wife, five children, one dog, two cats, and two rats. We will have a response.
Oh, you're doing it. All right. I'm sorry.
All right. We got a little misinformation here. We will actually have another paper, so this will be a double session, and this will be presented by Newell Bringhurst, and it is entitled
Samuel Brannan.
I'm sorry. Samuel Brannan is the title of it. And Mr. Bringhurst brings a great deal of experience to his topic. He has done a great deal of writing as well on the blacks in his publication of Saints, Slaves, and Blacks that came out in 1981. He also has done a biography of Brigham Young and the Expanding American Frontier, which was published in 1986. A biography on Fawn Brodie that is currently in progress. He has published a number of articles on Fawn Brodie, and he is currently working on books on Sam Brannan, and has done a number of articles on him as well. His additional works include current efforts to produce works on Thomas Kearns and the Ku Klux Klan. He is currently an instructor in history and political science at the College of the Sequoias. He has a Bachelor of Science at the University of Utah, his Master's at the University of Utah, and his PhD at the University of California. He has one wife, one daughter, and two dogs. We will begin with George Smith, followed by Samuel Brannan, and then we will have a question and answer period. Excuse me. Followed by the paper on Sam Brannan by Mr. Bringhurst.
The subject of this paper is Mormon Plural Marriage and Historical Perspective. My name is George Smith. After a century and a half, we might ask what the place in Mormon belief system is of plural marriage and how this practice relates to the longer history of communal marriage patterns. Polygamy, marriage to more than one person at the same time, is apparently not reflected in the fossil record of Homo erectus or Neanderthal. A recent study of the evolution of man and human sexuality concludes that while modern man is culturally obliged often to be monogamous, he is biologically built for promiscuity. Therefore, it should come as no surprise that polygamy has been a common practice in many parts of the world. Polygamy has been found in India, Nepal, the Orient, the Middle East, Africa, Indonesia, Australia, in early Germanic culture, and among certain Indians of the Americas and Eskimos of the Arctic, not to mention the Mormons of North America. Among the Achagua Indians of Venezuela and Colombia, the Jikok Indians in Honduras, and the Aborigines of Australia's Western District, some men have three or four wives, technically polygyny. Among the Natal peoples of South Africa and the Maasai of East Africa, each plural wife has her own hut in a group of huts surrounding a livestock enclosure called a kraal, similar to our term corral. In the Melanesian and Micronesian islands of the South Pacific, polygamy provides a means of accumulating agricultural wealth in a matrilineal society. Polyandry, a woman's marriage to more than one man, is widespread among the Pahari people of the Himalayas, where several brothers typically share one or more wives. Eskimo marriage, adapted to the requirements of Arctic hunting by cooperative family groups, allows a man to settle down with an unmarried woman, either within his own family group or another, and a woman might cohabit with several men in succession or at one time in a polyandrous relationship, or if a man, especially skilled male hunter, for example, might have two or more wives. The institution of marriage, however, has generally evolved toward monogamy. Multiple wives and concubines of ancient Mesopotamia were portrayed in the Old Testament by early Hebrew writers. Abraham, David, and Solomon had many wives, but Jewish law had normalized monogamy by the 11th century. Polygamy was also found in pre-Islamic Arab cultures of the Middle East, Asia, and North Africa. Later, the Quran would limit Muslim husbands to a maximum of four wives. In Japan and China, up to the 20th century, wealthy men were expected to take several concubines. Ancient Roman law recognized three forms of marriage: by solemn ceremony, usually among dignitaries, by purchase, and by simple mutual consent or extended cohabitation. The marriage law of most Western nations is the product of Roman Catholic canon law, which recognizes marriage as a lifelong monogamous union between a woman and a man by consent and consummation. Polygamy is generally forbidden. In the 19th century America, amidst large-scale immigration, they experimented with new ways to assemble people in a community. In his study, Religion and Sexuality, Lawrence Foster examined the experience of three religious groups that many of you are perhaps familiar with. The religious orders of the Shakers, the Oneidas, and the Mormons. Each of these communal societies seemed to derive its own social system from a common passage in the New Testament, which states that children of the resurrection, quote, may neither marry nor are given in marriage. This is from Luke. Now, the Shaker prophet Ann Lee understood this passage to rule out marital relations in heaven. In 1770, in a Manchester, England jail, Ann Lee experienced a vision of Adam and Eve in carnal intercourse. This vision convinced her that sexual relations were the transgression which resulted in the fall of humanity. She brought her group of Shakers, Shaking Quakers, to America in 1784 and developed revivalist celibate communities that shook, shouted, and spoke in tongues for about a century from Maine to Indiana. John Humphrey Noyes, founder of the Oneida Perfectionist Society, groups in Vermont and New York, concluded from the biblical passage that monogamous marriage contracts would not exist in the afterlife, but that love relationships would be universal and free among all peoples. So in this experimental community of the Oneidas, Noyes established a utopia in which group marriage within an enlarged family replaced the traditional monogamous marriage. Seeking to eliminate the assignment of a woman to a man as an exclusive form of property, Noyes set up a community home in which each is married to all. Now, this complex marriage, as he called it, lasted about 30 years, from 1848 to 1879. The Latter-day Saints, who incorporated into their society in Illinois and later in Utah a relatively successful form of plural marriage, began as a small millennialist community in western New York State, formed in 1830, as you know, around the revelations and miraculous translations of Joseph Smith. With a third interpretation of this passage in Luke, Smith advocated a marriage that was eternal but had to be accomplished in the here and now. As a significant feature of this new doctrine, the prophet presented an 1843 revelation on celestial marriage, which allowed several virgins for each priesthood holder. Smith first revealed this heavenly practice to a few trusted followers within their Nauvoo, Illinois community. Smith's private clerk, William Clayton, recorded a 10-page revelation which restored the practice of Moses, Abraham, David, and Solomon having many wives and concubines. The prophet dictated a new and everlasting covenant in which, if any man, quoting, espouse a virgin and desire to espouse another, or if he have 10 virgins given unto him by this law, he cannot commit adultery, for they belong to him. A portion of the revelation was directed to Joseph Smith's wife, Emma, apparently to elicit her cooperation. Smith dictated to Clayton, a commandment I give unto mine handmaid Emma Smith, your wife, by which Emma was to receive all that had been given unto my servant Joseph. Emma was then warned, if she would not abide in the commandment, she shall be destroyed, saith the Lord, for I will destroy her if she not abide in the law. When the revelation was read to Emma, she said, according to Clayton's journal, that she did not believe a word of it and appeared very rebellious. For the rest of her life, Emma, as you also know, denied that her husband had ever practiced polygamy. Although Mormon plural marriage before the 1840s is conjectural, some suggest that Smith advocated polygamy as early as 1831, when he presented a revelation directing several married elders to take Indian women as wives, that their posterity may become white, delightsome, and just. Rumors of Smith's own liaisons had circulated for a decade before polygamy was institutionalized within the Mormon community. But Mormon polygamy had clearly begun by April 5, 1841, with Joseph Smith's first officially recorded plural marriage in Nauvoo, Illinois. In a ceremony beside the Mississippi River, the prophet married 26-year-old Louisa Beeman, disguised in a man's hat and coat. The ceremony was performed by Beeman's brother-in-law, using words dictated by the prophet. At that time, Smith was 35 and had been married 14 years to 36-year-old Emma Hale Smith. They had 6 children. By the time the prophet dictated his revelation on celestial or plural marriage in 1843, he had already taken at least 12 plural wives, marriages kept secret from all but a few trusted members. Smith courted these plural wives with descriptions of eternal marriage and accounts of revelation. In the case of 16-year-old Lucy Walker, one of 4 sibling children Smith had adopted and whom Emma had helped Emma with her housework, the prophet said that God had commanded him to take her as a wife. Although angry and insulted, more than that, she seemed to fear Smith's warning that if she rejected the principle of plural marriage, the gate would be closed forever against you. On May 1, 1843, while Emma was shopping for supplies in St. Louis, Lucy was married to Joseph Smith. Now, some women were less persuaded. A dramatic account of a woman's resistance to polygamy lies in the story of Apostle Orsa and Sarah Pratt. After Joseph Smith approached Orson's wife Sarah in the spring of 1842, she exposed him to her husband, who confronted Smith. Orson was excommunicated, reinstated, and later took plural wives himself and became the primary apologist for plural marriage when it was officially announced in Utah in 1852. Sarah ultimately left both Orson and the church, labeled polygamy as the direst curse which completely demoralizes good men and makes bad men correspondingly worse. As for the women, she wrote, well, God help them. When Joseph Smith proposed to Nancy Rigdon, the daughter of his close friend, he reportedly took her into a room, locked the door, and then stated to her that he had an affection for her for several years, wished that she should be his. Rigdon refused him. The following day, Smith explained in a letter to her, that which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another. He added, whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reason thereof. The prophet extended this assertion of legitimacy to the marriage of women living with or with women with living husbands. He presumed a sort of droit de seigneur, a right to the brides of his domain, as it were. On October 27, 1841, Smith married Zina B. Huntington while she was married to Henry B. Jacobs and was 6 months pregnant with Jacobs' child. On December 11, 1841, Smith married her sister, Priscinda Huntington, who had been married to Norman Buell 14 years and remained married to him until 1846, 5 years later. Smith married Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner in February 1842, when she was already married and 8 months pregnant. Mary Elizabeth was just 13 years old when she had first met the prophet in Kirtland, Ohio, and as she recalled, quote, "The Savior appeared and commanded him to seal me up to everlasting life and gave me to Joseph to be with him in the kingdom." 3 years later, Joseph told her, "The angel came to him three times, the last time with a drawn sword, and threatened to take his life. Joseph said, 'I was his before I came here,' and he said, 'All the devils in hell should never get me from him.'" Although married to Joseph Smith, Leitner lived with another husband and had 8 children by him. 2 months later, in April 1842, Nancy Marinda Johnson married Joseph Smith while her husband Orson Hyde was on a mission to Jerusalem. After Hyde returned, his wife continued to live with him. Unlike later Mormon polygamists, Smith did not accrue a large, conspicuous family. Though these women did not live under the same roof or name children after Smith, they were, according to Mormon doctrine, married to Smith for eternity. For young girls living in the Smith home, the prophet's advances were hard to refuse. After the death of their father, Emily and Eliza Partridge came to live with and care for Smith's baby boy, Don Carlos. Each of the sisters became married to the prophet, at first without Emma's knowledge, and again in a sermon which she consented to. Emily wrote in her diary, "From that very hour, Emma was our bitter enemy." Later that same year, Joseph Smith married another pair of sisters, Maria and Sarah Lawrence, young heiresses for whom he had served as executor and guardian. The following year, the prophet's counselor, William Law, who had been a loyal supporter until he had discovered Smith's practice of polygamy, charged Smith in the circuit court of Hancock County, Illinois, with living with Maria Lawrence, quote, "in an open state of adultery." The prophet responded by secretly excommunicating Law. The following month, Law and other Mormons dissented from polygamy and aired in a new newspaper the Nauvoo Expositor and Exposé of Joseph Smith's Mormon Seraglio, or Nauvoo Harem, as they called it, and his unparalleled and unheard-of attempts at seduction, end quote. Smith, as Nauvoo's mayor, had the newspaper destroyed, an act which resulted in his arrest by the state of Illinois and his lynching by a mob. During the 2.5 years from his first official plural marriage in April 1841 to his last known marriage in November of 1843, Smith had secretly taken as many as 45 wives, one or two at a time. This number averages out to about 1.5 each month. By the close of 1843, it had been observed that most friends of Smith's legal wife, Emma, had either married her husband or had given their daughters to him. Assistant church historian Andrew Young obtained data on Smith's marriages from records the saints kept of their temple ceremonies in Nauvoo and later in Salt Lake. He also collected statements from Smith's former wives who willingly confirmed that they had shared full conjugal relations with the prophet. Jensen published these documents in 1887, primarily in an attempt to convince Smith's family, who had remained in the Midwest after his death, that their progenitor had in fact practiced polygamy. The very necessity for such a debate attested to the secrecy of polygamy in Nauvoo. In 1845, most Latter-day Saints thought that polygamy was an unfounded anti-Mormon accusation. Only about 25 families, or arguably maybe more, among the 15,000 to 20,000 people living in Nauvoo practiced polygamy while Smith was alive. Most of these were the prophet's intimate colleagues. Younger women were secretly instructed in plural marriage by older women previously inducted into the secret order. Most of Smith's plural wives were housed with other families, which he visited periodically. His secretary, William Clayton, recorded one such visit to Almira Johnson on May 16, 1843. Quote, "Press Joseph and I went to Benjamin F. Johnson's to sleep." Johnson later noted that on this visit, Smith stayed with Almira as man and wife and occupied the same room and bed with my sister that the previous month he had occupied with the daughter of the late Bishop Partridge as his wife. Almira Johnson also confirmed her secret marriage to Joseph Smith. Quote, "I lived with the Prophet Joseph as his wife, and he visited me at the home of my brother Benjamin F." So from several sources, you can put together a construct of a picture of visiting dispersed plural family relationships. The question of how many children came from these plural marriages has never been decisively answered. Josephine L. Fisher wrote that her mother, Sylvia Sessions, told her that Josephine was the daughter of the prophet Joseph Smith. Priscinda Huntington Buell once said that, quote, "she did not know whether Mr. Buell or the prophet was the father of her son Oliver Buell." Researchers have identified, however, only about 8 possible polygamous children of Joseph Smith. Scanty evidence of children for a man who had 45 wives, albeit for just 2.5 years. Expressing her view of secret polygamy in Nauvoo, Emily Partridge observed, "Spiritual wives, as we were then termed, were not very numerous in those days, and a spiritual baby was a rarity indeed." In his recently published journals, Smith's secretary, William Clayton, provides an intimate and contemporary view of how the prophet initiated other men into the practice and what advice he gave regarding risks of pregnancy. Early in 1843, Smith came to call at the Clayton residence. William and Ruth had been married 6 years and had 3 children. Clayton related that the prophet had invited him to go for a walk, during which he said he had learned of a sister back in England to whom Clayton was very much attached. Clayton acknowledged the friendship, but said there was nothing further in this but a relationship between a brother and a sister in the church, and it was entirely proper. The prophet then suggested, "Why don't you send for her?" Clayton replied, "In the first place, I have no authority to send for her, and if I had, I have not the means to pay expenses." Smith answered, quote, "I give you authority to send for her, and I will furnish you with means," which he did, according to Clayton. Noting that this day in early in 1843 was the first time the prophet had talked to him on the subject of plural marriage, Clayton recalled the prophet's further sanction. "It is your privilege to have all the wives you want," he said. Smith also told Clayton that he had other wives living besides his first wife, Emma, and in particular gave me, Clayton, to understand that Eliza R. Snow, Louisa Beeman, Desdemona, Fulmer, and others were his lawful wives in the sight of heaven. But Smith never publicly acknowledged the polygamous relationships he had just enumerated to Clayton. In fact, the next year in 1844, when accused of committing adultery and having 7 wives, the prophet declared before a Mormon congregation that he could, quote, "find only one." Clayton's first plural wife was his legal wife's sister, Margaret Moon. Soon afterward, Margaret became pregnant, and Clayton sought Joseph Smith's advice. The prophet advised Clayton to, quote, "just keep her at home and book it, and if they raise trouble about it and bring you before me, I will give you an awful scourging and probably cut you off from the church, and then I will baptize you and set you ahead as good as ever." That same year, Clayton asked the prophet's permission to marry the third sister, Lydia Moon. Smith denied this request, citing a recent revelation that, quote, "a man could only take 2 sisters of a family." But he then turned to Clayton and asked if he would give Lydia to him. Clayton willingly petitioned Lydia for Smith, but Lydia refused the prophet's offer, citing that she had promised her mother she would not yet marry. Following Smith's admonition, Clayton fully embraced plural marriage. Later in Utah, he wrote, quote, "I support a family of near 40 persons on a salary of $3,600 a year, and we live well, are well clothed, and very comfortably situated. I have 6 wives whom I support in comfort and happiness, and am not afraid of another one. I have 3 children born to me during the year, and I don't fear a dozen more. Clayton married a total of 10 women and fathered 47 children. In early 1846, a year and a half after Joseph Smith's death, the Saints had fled Nauvoo for the Great Salt Lake Valley, then a part of Mexico. 5 years after they arrived, the Mormon community announced what many people had long suspected, that they practiced polygamy. Now, over 50 years, Mormon polygamy grew from a secret practice among Smith and his close associates in Nauvoo to a flourishing institution throughout the Great Basin Kingdom. Participation in plural marriage contributed to advancement in the church, but as you might have expected, not to the good standing in as an American citizen. By this time, the United States had acquired the Utah Territory from Mexico, and opposition to polygamy became institutionalized in national politics. The Republican platform of 1856 vowed to eradicate the twin relics of barbarism, slavery, and polygamy. The Edmunds-Tucker Act of 1887 put teeth into early anti-polygamy laws, and in 1890, when the federal government threatened to confiscate church property, LDS President Wilford Woodruff issued a manifesto advising Latter-day Saints to refrain from contracting any marriage forbidden by the laws of the land. Since plural marriage had been taught as an essential qualification for the highest degree of salvation, the reversal was painful for devout church members. It was also incomplete. Church-sponsored polygamy continued underground for several years, and many new marriages were performed in Mormon colonies in Mexico to escape U.S. controls. After the LDS Church ostensibly rescinded the practice of plural marriage, Utah was granted statehood in 1896. Utah State Constitution declared that polygamy or plural marriages are forever prohibited. However, soon after statehood had been attained, the incidence of plural marriage had begun to increase, and the Salt Lake Tribune then accused Mormon leaders of bad faith. The hearings to confirm Reed Smoot, a U.S. senator, was widely publicized that Mormons continued polygamy, and followed soon was the second manifesto in 1905, wherein the LDS Church unequivocally proscribed the practice of plural marriage. New Mormon leadership in 1918 began to excommunicate polygamists, and in the 1930s even assisted in their prosecution. In 1935, the Utah legislature made polygamy a felony, and some polygamy cases even reached the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1936, to dissociate itself even further from polygamy, the Mormon Church administered a loyalty oath to suspected polygamists. Church members were required to deny that it was ever practiced, or by them. Under such pressure, excommunicated polygamists began to organize, calling themselves fundamentalist Mormons, or just fundamentalists. Large fundamentalist colonies concentrated in Arizona and Utah still practice polygamy in the belief that they are following God's will. Polygamy raids and mass arrests have been discontinued, and neighbors and law enforcement officials now generally turn the other cheek, look the other way. Fundamentalists, which number about 30,000 in the U.S., Western Canada, and Mexico, are generally modest people with sexually restrictive mores. In Colorado City, Arizona, women in polygamous families wear plain dresses to the wrists, ankles, and neck to cover religious garments. Their long hair is worn in a tight bun, and they use no makeup. Men wear long-sleeved shirts buttoned to the neck. Their hair is short. Their face is clean-shaven. Fundamentalists consider themselves Mormons but have separate organizations and practices. Plural marriage is often arranged for young teenage women by parents and religious leaders. In a recent editorial in the New York Times entitled My Husband's 9 Wives, plural wife Elizabeth Joseph, an attorney who lives in Big Water, Utah, tells a familiar story. She writes, "I married a married man. When I leave for work at 7 a.m., my 2-year-old daughter, London, is happily asleep in the bed of my husband's wife, Diane. London adores Diane. Elizabeth shares a home with another wife and spends most nights relaxing with their 3 children after a simple dinner. Mondays, however, are different. That's the night Alex, her husband, eats with us. The kids, excited that their father is coming to dinner, are on their best behavior. She emphasizes it's a special event because it only happens once a week. On the other nights, if Elizabeth finds that she is longing for intimacy and comfort that only Alex can provide, she can talk to the other wife and work out an arrangement. Elizabeth Joseph just recently came down to Stanford University and spoke before a group in quite an interesting interview, which was published the following day in the Stanford Daily. The legal ramifications of polygamy are now again in flux. A recent Utah Supreme Court case recognized the right of polygamous family to adopt children, thus implying that such families can be recognized within the law. In our society of multifamily households and less rigid mores, it's possible that polygamy could again become a legal practice. Perhaps not again among mainstream Mormons. For a century, the LDS Church sought to divest itself of plural marriage. Yet even now, Mormons practice a little-known and rarely discussed form of afterlife polygamy. When a wife dies, her husband may marry again and accumulate the second or third wife for part of his family in the afterlife. A woman, of course, does not receive the same opportunity to accrue husbands. So far beyond governmental reach, this de facto variant of plural marriage, inaugurated by Joseph Smith 150 years ago in Nauvoo, Illinois, continues. Thank you.
I'm going to be talking about Sam Brannum. Obviously not Sam Brannum, but anyway, it sort of reminds me of a little story that when I was doing my Brigham Young biography, there's an intimate relationship that develops between a biographer and their subject, and you become very much involved with that individual. And when I was working on Brigham Young, it was a very intense period for about a year while I was doing the actual writing. And I remember I went to bed one night and I actually dreamed I was Brigham Young, and it was scary. I woke up the next morning and I told my wife. She wasn't too thrilled with that their dream, for reasons that George has suggested in his paper. Okay, I'm spokesman for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Tend to dismiss Sam Brannum as the classic Mormon apostate who paid the ultimate price for his apostasy. Thus, Brannum is popularly portrayed as a one-time devout Latter-day Saint and church leader who simply rejected Mormonism for selfish personal reasons and in the end paid the price for his folly. A Deseret News obituary at the time of Brannum's death in 1889 observed that, quote, Brannum was once a Mormon and obtained some prominence in early times, but that his course and habits were not consistent with the life of a Latter-day Saint, and he was disconnected with the church and plunged into the speculative excitement of the pioneer California experience. The news then carefully noted that Brannum was at one time quite wealthy, but finally drifted into poverty. Condescendingly, the news did concede that Brannum did have some redeeming qualities, and it is to be hoped that these outweigh his faults, concluding, poor Sam will be the general expression over the news of his departure to another sphere. More recent Mormon accounts also viewed the one-time Mormon in a similar light. Carter Grant, in a church history text published in 1955 and used extensively in Latter-day Saint seminaries and institutes of religion, gave the following eulogy of Brannum. At last, he found himself a penniless drunkard. His wife divorced him. His friends left him. Broken in health and spirits, he died neglected and forgotten. In a similar vein, Eugene E. Campbell even went so far as to question Brannum's basic commitment to the church. According to Campbell, quote, there can be no question as to whether Brannum was a baptized active member of the church, but there has been some conjecture as to whether he was a sincere convert. Such negative renderings of Samuel Brannum oversimplify and distort the true nature of Samuel Brannum's changing relationship to the Latter-day Saint movement. Actually, Brannan was, for a significant period of his life, a devout, committed Latter-day Saint, whose ultimate disaffection came gradually, and then only as the result of a complex set of circumstances. In order to fully understand these circumstances, it is necessary to examine the varied aspects of Brannan's life and personality. In his physical appearance, Brannan was distinctive, standing 6'2" tall, deep-chested, broad-shouldered, and shaggy-haired. He was considered handsome, with his broad forehead, his brilliant dark eyes, and dandified dress. Observers noted that his courage and generosity were boundless, and that he was quick to win the respect of his associates due to his straightforward, outspoken fearlessness. He was, moreover, a restless, uprooted visionary and eternal optimist who throughout his life continually sought new horizons and new adventure. Born in 1819 in Saco, Maine, the sixth and youngest son of Irish immigrant parents, Brannan joined the church along with his older sister and brother-in-law in the wake of their migration to Kirtland, Ohio. Brannan's initial devotion to his new faith was demonstrated in several ways throughout the 1830s and 1840s. During the 1830s, he contributed his time and labor to the construction of the Kirtland Temple. In the early 1840s, Brannan was set apart to do missionary work throughout Ohio. By the mid-1840s, Brannan, who had demonstrated his talents as an able newspaper man, was called on by the church to assist William Smith, Joseph the Prophet's younger brother, in the editing of a church periodical called The Prophet, which had its headquarters in New York City. This he did over the next several years until early 1846. In the wake of Joseph Smith's death, Brannan ultimately cast his lot with Brigham Young, and by early 1846 was ordered to round up a group of East Coast Mormons, outfit a ship, and proceed to take it around the Horn to San Francisco. Brannan's ship, the Brooklyn, with 238 passengers, departed New York on February 4th, 1846, which coincidentally and ironically was the same exact date that Brigham Young departed Nauvoo for the West with the first Pioneer Company. Brannan and the Brooklyn arrived in San Francisco on July 31st, 1846. Following his arrival in California, Brannan, in further demonstration of his commitment to the church, started an agricultural settlement on the Stanislaus River in the fertile San Joaquin Valley, calling his settlement New Hope. Here he hoped that Brigham Young would lead the main contingent of the saints under his leadership, thereby selecting California as Mormonism's new primary gathering place. However, this was not to be, and within 5 years, Brannan had been excommunicated from the church. As I suggested at the beginning of my presentation, no one factor but a complex set of circumstances led to Brannan's excommunication. Following Joseph Smith's death, Brannan ran into difficulty with Brigham Young when he showed some initial support for William Smith, who was himself questioning Young's leadership, with the prophet's younger brother ultimately excommunicated by mid-1845. To make matters worse, Brannan was accused of promoting the still-secret practice of plural marriage, which led to an effort by Brigham Young and other church leaders to disfellowship Brannan in April of 1845. However, Brannan managed to convince church leaders of his innocence and was soon restored to full fellowship. More serious for Brannan was the misunderstanding that developed between Brannan and Young over the ultimate destination and main gathering place for the westward migrating Mormons. Brannan was led to believe, or wanted to believe, that California was to be the Mormons' final gathering place. Brannan's settlement and promotion of the Mormon agricultural colony of New Hope was a manifestation of this belief or this hope. Thus, during the summer of 1847, Brannan journeyed west from San Francisco to meet with Brigham Young and the westward migrating saints who hadn't yet arrived in the Great Salt Lake Valley. He was extremely dismayed to find out that they had intended to to stop at and settle the Great Basin as and make that Mormonism's primary gathering place. At this very critical point, the disappointed Brannan returned to California and devoted his major energies to secular activities. Thus, he opened a general store in Sacramento near Sutter's Fort. In early 1848, Brannan found himself at the center of the drama surrounding the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill. The gold discovery and the gold rush were a great boon to Brannan, who, according to one estimate, did $150,000 a month in business. This income, combined with timely investments in hotels, real estate, and shipping, made Brannan California's first millionaire. But in the meantime, Brannan found himself increasingly at odds with Brigham Young, and thus cast into the role of Mormon dissenter. This was due to several factors. First, Brannan came to detest polygamy with a passion, despite his earlier initial support. Brannan was also concerned about his status as a church leader in light of the fact that he had not received his temple endowments, unlike many of the other church leaders at that time, because many of those people had gone through the temple at Nauvoo, before they came to the Great Basin, and he, of course, hadn't been in Nauvoo. A third point of conflict involved Brannan's failure to turn over to the church tithes collected by him from Mormon gold seekers at the mining camp of Mormon Island. More serious was Brannan's failure to pay tithing on his own increasingly large fortune. In April 1849, Young wrote Brannan, quote, "I shall expect $10,000, at least your tithing. Warning, if you want to continue to prosper, do not forget the Lord's treasury, lest he forget you. And with the liberal, the Lord is liberal." The Mormon leader then made a personal request, quote, "I want you to remember that Brother Brigham has long been destitute of a home and suffered heavy losses and incurred great expenses. He wants you to send him $20,000, a present, in gold dust to help him with his labors. It is but a trifle where gold is so plentiful, but will do much good at this time." Young's letter also informed Brannan that Apostle Amasa A. Lyman was on his way to California to collect the money in question. This precipitated the final break between Brannan and the church. By the time that Lyman arrived in July of 1850, Brannan had disclaimed all connection with the church. According to one oft-quoted remark, Brannan allegedly offered to turn the tithing over to Lyman if Lyman would produce a receipt signed by the Lord. Brannan's formal excommunication, however, did not occur until August 1851. In ordering Brannan's disfellowship, the church cited Brannan's general course of unchristian-like conduct, neglect of duty, and combining with lawless assemblies to commit murder and other crimes. Thus ended Brannan's 18-year association with the church. In the wake of his excommunication, Brannan did not succumb to self-indulgent narcissistic behavior, contrary to popular Mormon myth. Instead, Brannan went on to become an important California civic and community leader, and indeed, he became a builder of Pioneer California. The force behind the establishment of San Francisco and indeed California's first public school system. In August 1849, he was elected to the San Francisco Town Council, which directly involved him in various other community concerns. In 1849, Brannan helped finance the construction of the so-called Long Wharf, which for many years served as San Francisco's major point of disembarkation. Brannan helped to finance other construction within the city. In the words of one writer, he built all the first substantial buildings which made San Francisco a really metropolitan city. Brannan's most controversial civic action within San Francisco was, without question, his involvement with that city's Committee of Vigilance. The formation of this vigilante committee resulted from the concern of Brannan and other prominent San Franciscans over the disruptive activities of lawless elements within the city. This vigilant action, which, while effectively dealing with the immediate lawlessness within the city,
contributed to Brannan's disaffection for Mormonism. It was specifically cited by church officials as one of the reasons for Brannan's excommunication, as I earlier pointed out, that is, combining with lawless elements to commit murder and other crimes. However, Brannan's vigilance involvement is viewed in a much more favorable light by the noted California historian Hubert Howe Bancroft, who described it, quote, as the brightest epic in Brannan's eventful life, noting that so long as society holds its course in San Francisco, Brannan's name should be held in honored and grateful remembrance. Outside of San Francisco, Brannan was also involved in a variety of civic activities. In February 1847, he was one of the leaders in funding and organizing a relief expedition to rescue the Donner Party lost in the California mountains. In 1849, he was a leader in a special constitutional convention called to organize a state government for California. During that meeting, held in San Jose in March 1849, Brannan offered a resolution declaring that the delegates to this convention be instructed to oppose slavery in every possible form. Brannan's action marked the first time ever that anyone in California had spoke out in public against the introduction of black servitude, and indeed stood in sharp contrast to the opposite actions taken by Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders back in Utah, granting legal recognition to black slavery in that territory. Outside of California, Brannan involved himself in a highly unusual enterprise, a filibustering expedition to Hawaii. He organized and led a group of 24 close associates on this adventure, or rather misadventure, in November 1851. Brannan intended to stage a bloodless coup by persuading the inept Hawaiian king, King Kamehameha III, who was not any great shakes, to abdicate in favor of Brannan, who would take personal control of the islands, assuming the title of Governor General. However, Brannan encountered greater than expected resistance from Hawaii residents who rushed to the support of their besieged king. In the end, Brannan failed, but did anticipate the ultimate American takeover of the islands by some 50 years. Undaunted by this failure, Brannan continued to expand his business and financial interests throughout California. In 1859, he bought 2,000 acres of prime Napa Valley land on which he built a huge resort near the hot springs of Calistoga, a name inadvertently coined by Brannan himself while in an inebriated state, during which he meant to declare that he would build the resort that would be the Saratoga of California, but instead he committed a spoonerism and christened it the Calistoga of Serafonia. In 1868, he turned his attention to Southern California and, in one of the greatest real estate deals of his career, purchased the entire estate of the prominent early Californio Abel Stearns, some 170 acres in Los Angeles County. He opened the Stearns estate to small farmers and thus stimulated the settlement of the southern counties of California. All of these varied activities on the part of Brannan should put to rest once and for all the popular Mormon myth that the one-time Latter-day Saint became little more than a drunken, destitute derelict in the immediate wake of his excommunication from the church. However, by the mid-1860s, some 10 years after his excommunication, Brannan's fortunes did go into a state of decline. He overextended himself in his numerous and varied land ventures. To make matters worse, he had to face the economic consequences of an 1869 divorce from his wife, Ann Eliza. As you know, in California, they have the law of community property, and he was caught up in that. To secure this final settlement, he was forced to liquidate his holdings. Finally, Brannan's increasingly heavy drinking precipitated the almost total collapse of what was left of his financial empire. However, in the 1880s, Brannan attempted a financial comeback in an effort based on $1.5 million in Mexican war bonds that he had purchased during more flush days in the early 1860s. He traded these war bonds to the Mexican government for conditional title to 1.7 million acres of land in Sonora, Mexico, which would become Brannan's outright if he could survey and, more important, get people to colonize it. With renewed optimism, Brannan moved into the region to personally direct the the surveying and colonizing efforts. Branham also renewed his contact with the Mormons as part of his effort to attract settlers. First, he enlisted the support of Jesse Little, an old friend and Mormon whom Branham had known back in the 1840s. Branham made Little an official agent for his land company with the assignment of securing settlers. Branham then wrote then-Mormon President John Taylor, offering Taylor part of his grant if Taylor would encourage Latter-day Saints to settle there. Such a Mormon migration seemed a realistic possibility during the 1880s, since a significant number of Latter-day Saints were at that time fleeing the United States for various settlements both in Mexico and Canada in response to the increasingly intense federal government anti-polygamy campaign. At the same time, Branham himself, then 63, with a renewed burst of youthful energy, met and remarried a 35-year-old Mexican widow. But Branham's optimism concerning possible Mormon migration onto his land was short-lived. He was unable to attract settlers to this region due to its arid climate and presence of hostile, restless Indians. Moreover, Latter-day Saint leaders and potential Mormon settlers might have also been turned off by Branham's openly hostile attitude toward Mormon polygamy. Branham was plagued by other problems. He suffered a stroke, a bout with yellow fever, and was deserted by his Mexican wife. He was then forced to return to Southern California in dire financial straits and racked by arthritic pain. Branham, however, remained optimistic concerning his future prospects. By this time, he had given up his excessive drinking and somehow had managed to scrape together enough money to buy a prune orchard near Escondido. He talked of the great profits he expected to harvest. However, the years had taken their toll on Branham's 70-year-old body, if not his spirit, and he died at Escondido on May 6, 1889. In conclusion, it is clear that Sam Branham's role as a Mormon dissenter was much more complex than the superficial one-dimension image presented in popular Mormon accounts. Branham's evolution from a devout, committed Latter-day Saint into a dissenter came gradually and only as the result of a set of complex, sometimes interrelated, circumstances. It is true that Branham did have his faults and his weaknesses, as we all do. But in overall terms, it is also clear that Branham was both a leading builder of Pioneer California as well as one of the most noteworthy dissenters to ever come out of the Latter-day Saint tradition. Thank you. The question that was asked is, what was the relationship between Samuel Branham and Walter Murray Gibson? Gibson came along somewhat later. I mean, Branham's involvement in Hawaii was just a very transitory, a very fleeting thing. It was over and done very quickly, and Branham, you know, quickly moved on to other activities. So I'm not aware of any type of interrelationship.
The question is, do I personally regard the principle of polygamy as to be divinely inspired? I guess I'm not qualified to regard the principle of polygamy. I would certainly direct that question to somebody like William Clayton, who, from my understanding, did regard it as such and practiced it with full understanding that his afterlife was dependent upon how he fulfilled those requirements. William Clayton journals have been published to the extent they are available. There are some portions of them which are in the First Presidency's vault. I don't know if you heard the initial discussion earlier this morning, but there are several vaults. The majority of the diaries are in a published form, and those that have not been published are identified by topic and by alternate references where you can find reference to those subjects. The question is whether in the in the case of polyandry, where there are women whose husbands have died, women who have been sealed to those husbands can therefore go ahead and be sealed to new husbands. I'm going to have to plead ignorance on that. Does anybody have any information on that? I am not aware of that. Do you have a specific date or a reference?
I remember it's never the
Brown. A church bulletin in what year?
About 4 years ago.
4 years ago. And, yes.
The way the bulletin is worded.
Yes. Here's the authentic answer.
The way the bulletin was worded originally is a woman can be sealed to subsequent husbands only after death. So if you're doing your genealogical research and you find that your great-grandmother was married three times in the course of her life, she can be sealed to all three of those husbands. But if she is a living woman remarrying, she cannot be sealed to a second husband.
The question is, how does one reconcile the apparent promiscuity of Joseph Smith regarding plural marriage with the high standards of morality which the church clearly does sustain? I don't know how people generally do reconcile those two things. I don't know if I'm sure it's not. It's called something other than promiscuous. Just what it was is a little ambiguous. The fact came out after the fact. It was not really known that there were plural marriages by Joseph Smith in secret until years and years later, especially confirmed by the church historian Andrew Jensen, as I mentioned, that did have a particular purpose in arguing the case with the RLDS Church. And historians later began to correlate the diaries of the various women involved and the various other citizens of Nauvoo. It seemed like there was an intention to be marriages. They do sound promiscuous to some ears, but he certainly characterized them as marriages, and his statements to the women, as revealed by their own letters and diaries, suggest that he was doing this in the with the sanction of a divine source. He presented that to those women in that way. Now, on the other hand, you see Emma's resistance, his legal wife's resistance to these other relationships. Clearly, there was some struggle in the community, and I'm not sure quite how to reconcile it. But it could certainly seem promiscuous in that there were a lot of relationships. There was not an accumulation of wives as later Mormon polygamy developed, that these are my wives and she lives here and here and here and I live here and we visit. These were wives one or two at a time that would be married and then leave. And then there'd be some more and then leave. So the pattern was entirely different. You're referring to the circumstances of polyandry where Joseph Smith married apparently women who were already married, some during the terms of pregnancy. And I think when you add all those up, it sounds very unusual. And certainly in my neighborhood. But again, these are things that were not apparent until a long time after. And then even now, it's very difficult to discuss these questions. They seem embarrassing enough that I guess the institution does not like to bring those issues out all together in the same picture, because obviously they don't be that sort of thing you tend to bring new converts in with. So they're really not discussed in full color usually. Please. Yes. Mm-hmm. Just for the microphone, I'll repeat the comment suggests that the Lord did direct Joseph Smith to take these wives, and so I assume therefore the responsibility is not in Joseph's hands, but in some higher hands. From the tenor of your comment.
I'm sorry, our session is over, and we want to thank our presenters both.